From WNYC in New York, this is On the Evil Around Us. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Did I say evil? I meant media. Common mistake. In fact, on Friday, the Republican National Committee suspended its partnership with NBC News for the February debate, citing CNBC's bad faith in conducting this week's debate. Post-debate, just about every candidate's soundbite was about the bias, the triviality, the malicious intent of the media.
You know, the Democrats have the ultimate super PAC. It's called the mainstream media.
And yet, says BuzzFeed political reporter McKay Coppins, Marco Rubio, the GOP contender whose comment we just heard, could count the mainstream media as his staunchest ally. It anointed him the front runner long, long ago.
To be sure, he's always been kind of a very talented, dynamic political figure. At the same time, not since early 2013 has he even come close to leading in the national polls.
So what do the mainstream media mean when they call him the front runner?
I think what we in the press tend to actually mean is that he is the best candidate. You know, he comes from humble roots. He's young and good-looking and Latino. He's the Republican who, if the newsroom of the New York Times were operating the Republican Party, they would probably choose him as the nominee.
So 3 years before the election, he was Time Magazine's cover man as the Republican savior. Last year, you announced Rubio's comeback. What was the impact of all these pundit class pronouncements?
My pronouncement that he was making a comeback was followed by him sliding two more points in the polls over the next few months.
He rode the wave of excitement from sixth to seventh place.
Right. He really surged in the polls down one spot. I think that this gets at a larger point, which is that as much as political pundits and reporters like to act as though we have our fingers on the pulse of America, oftentimes our hyping of certain candidates actually has an adverse effect in terms of making conservatives distrust those candidates.
Right. And I think you've noted Chris Christie.
Yeah, I mean, his coziness in the MSNBC Morning Joe green room, which is the political chat show that the media elites like to watch every morning. He would go on that show all the time, and it really compounded conservatives' suspicion of him post-2012. Once the Bridgegate scandal happened and his administration was sort of reeling, you saw many leading conservative websites sit back and let him be devoured because they didn't feel like they needed to come to his defense.
Do you think one reason why the mainstream media simply don't have their fingers on the pulse of the GOP is because the mainstream media are mostly liberal?
Certainly, political liberalism is part of it. There's also a cultural liberalism. The mainstream media is very centered in Washington, D.C. and New York City. The best political journalists spend most of their time out on the campaign trail, but I think it's very easy for us in the media to sit in our Manhattan cubicles or Washington, D.C. offices and speculate, and it becomes an echo chamber that has very little to do with what Republican voters are actually thinking.
I want to modulate my observation for a moment here. I have a really deep theory, so stay with me.
Okay.
Which is that, yeah, the media are liberal. They're also conscious of the possibility that that bias might affect their work, and they're certainly keenly aware of the criticism they get if they appear to be displaying any of that bias. And so they love to focus on Republican moderates. That just makes them feel so comfortable and so good. So this consciousness of media bias, this criticism, tends to put them exactly in the Rubio zone.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think that the Republican Party has made very effective use of turning attacks on the mainstream media into a kind of ruthlessly effective political weapon. And that has caused the mainstream media to always be looking for Republicans that they can hold up and champion to show that they're not biased. I also definitely think that the media tend to gravitate toward the more centrist candidates. And I actually think that that's true on both sides. I think that there's a sort of instinctive, maybe lazy centrism that the national media tend to coalesce around.
I would take that even further and suggest that there is a kind of belief that the left is unelectable.
Mm-hmm.
Trump will get tons of attention, even though he's never seemed to be a likely electable candidate, whereas there is a kind of sense among the media that the really lefty candidate is just unelectable and therefore not worthy of the time that polls suggest they might have earned.
Mm-hmm. And I do think that part of this has to do with the rise of the Tea Party in 2010, which was a huge media phenomenon. And ever since that cycle, you've seen the press continue to gravitate toward those candidates. Now, I would say, though, there's a difference because Rubio is not really one of those kind of right-wing bomb throwers, right?
Isn't he, though?
He is conservative. He's very conservative policy-wise. But what the press likes about him is that he's very talented at taking his right-wing positions and making them sound very mainstream and appealing to the masses, and really, more importantly, to the reporters who cover them.
Let's talk about what happened briefly at the debate, where his tax plan was challenged, and he, like the rest of the contenders on that stage, decided to make it about the media.
Yeah, this is actually a fascinating tack that Rubio has taken, and he wasn't the only one to do it. Ted Cruz also, when asked about the debt ceiling, responded by lampooning the moderators for asking unsubstantive questions,
right,
and then declining to answer the substantive question he was asked.
Christie attacked the media, Trump attacked the media.
It's... Yeah, it became the way to kind of slither out of questions that you didn't want to answer. One thing that Rubio, I think, does so well is that he repeatedly attacks the mainstream media and attacks reporters for bias, but he does it in a very almost congenial way, where he does it in a way that nonetheless makes the media continue to like him.
When he calls the mainstream media Hillary Clinton's super PAC, that's congenial?
Well, ask the reporters in the media filing center that I was at. I don't think you saw a lot of reporters after he made that dig say, oh, that Marco Rubio, I'm going to go get him now. Instead, what you saw was an avalanche of stories declaring him the winner and once again hyping him as the emerging leader of the 2016 field. Time will tell whether he actually takes the lead in any polls, but as of now, he's in third or fourth place.
What do you think of what Alex Eisenstadt and Glenn Thrush wrote in Politico that, quote, Rubio has adopted a small mammal approach, maneuvering quietly at ground level, hoping that dinosaurs like Donald Trump, Jeb Bush, and Ben Carson ignore him while stomping each other into extinction?
I think that's true. I think that's been his strategy from the beginning.
Well, is this the moment where he emerges from beneath the sheltering shadow and becomes a dinosaur himself?
Well, I think that's the danger for him. He's enjoyed positive media attention all through this campaign cycle without necessarily being the main fixation of the mainstream media. And I know that his aides, they've told me this privately, that they actually didn't want him, at least they claim, to take the lead in national polls until December at the earliest.
Did they tell you he just has to be number one for one effing day?
I saw that quote in Politico. I haven't had it put to me that colorfully, but that is basically the sentiment, right? If there is a fear coming off the debate where he performed so well and generated once again another huge wave of media attention, is will he now become the target that everyone starts going after and trying to take down?
McKay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
McKay Coppins is the senior political writer for BuzzFeed.
For months now, Donald Trump has informed us that the polls suggest, affirm, nay, prove that he's a winner.
Leading all the polls, getting the biggest crowds, everybody's gone crazy.
I'm doing well. I'm leading in every poll, the little ones, the big ones.
And every week I go up, 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 up.
But this week, for the first time in over 100 days, the Republican field has a new leader, Ben Carson, topping several Iowa polls and a few national matchups. And that's shaking Trump's faith a little bit.
I generally believe in polls. The thing with these polls, they're all so different. They're coming from all over the lot, where one guy's up here and somebody else is up there, or you see swings of 10 and 12 points. So right now, it's not very scientific.
Yes, Donald, polls are stupid. at this stage of the election. But is Nate Silver, famed poll cruncher and editor-in-chief of the data news site 538, has observed, polls, no matter how unscientific, do fuel media narratives. And those narratives can affect voters and thus influence polls. It's a question of which comes first, the media egg or the chicken poll. To find the answer to that question on the media and Nate's 538, hereby begin a collaboration to track the push and pull between polling, media coverage, and public interest in candidates. Nate, welcome to our launch party of two.
Oh, thank you, Brett.
So, do candidates get more coverage because they're polling well, or do they poll well because they get more coverage? And there's more than enough polling and media frenzy a year out from 2016 to make this a compelling question.
I've never seen this much attention paid to polls so early in the campaign. And now it's October, it's a little bit more appropriate. But this was going on in June and July. In fact, the last time you had a candidate who was leading the polls at this point in the race and won was 16 years ago in 1999, Al Gore and George Bush.
These things are going to be swinging wildly for a while. For the purposes of our collaboration, what kind of metrics will you be using to help us track whether the rises and the falls of candidates were being pushed first by public interest and picked up by the media or the other way around?
We have a partnership already with Google because Google can track news hits, both how much candidates are covered and also the tone of coverage, and also search traffic, who's searching for whom in the debates. And it's turned out that in a couple of the GOP debates so far, search traffic proved a better guide to what comes after than kind of the media talk about the debates. Ben Carson, for example, at the first debate, you heard a lot of the press say, oh, he kind of was a non-entity. He's too soft-spoken. But after Trump, I think he got the second most search traffic, and lo and behold, he has moved up in the polls.
Now, for pretty much the entirety of Trump's lead, his polling success has been attributed to media attention, specifically the inability of the press to resist talking about him. Stephen Colbert likened this to binging on Oreos.
I've got to exercise some discipline. There you go. Look, you don't own me. And I don't need to play tape of you to have a successful TV show.
Over the past several months, about 60% of all media coverage of the GOP primary has been about Donald Trump. However, if you look at Google search traffic,
which is your principal metric of measuring
public
opinion,
interest, he gets 70% of the search traffic. In weeks where there is a debate, where other candidates get an equal stage, that's declined a little bit. But the public drives some of this, too.
So Trump may be difficult to track that way. It's media coverage, it's public interest fueling media coverage, which then fuels public interest and so on. But it's the opposite case with Ben Carson, right?
That's right. In this case, the Google searches came before the media spikes for Carson. So I think it's hard to put Carson and Trump in the same category.
Many Democrats have argued that the media are suppressing public interest in Bernie Sanders by vastly undercovering him.
There was a lag. I think there were points early in the race where people were searching for Bernie Sanders and maybe more importantly, saying they would consider voting for Bernie Sanders and didn't get much coverage. But I think that complaint is a month or two out of date. When you write articles about Bernie Sanders, they're as popular as articles about Donald Trump. People are really into listening and reading about Bernie Sanders. And so when organizations figure that out, then that changes their behavior some. I mean, he's now kind of immortalized as a Saturday Night Live icon, has kind of become a part of the culture. So I don't buy that now, for the past few weeks, Bernie Sanders has been undercovered. Now you're going to have several Democratic debates where it's all going to be kind of on Bernie Sanders' terms about policy issues that don't ordinarily get a hearing.
One thing that we're going to be talking about is something that's called discovery scrutiny decline.
Mm-hmm.
This is the pattern whereby candidates may surge, then the press start asking questions about him or her, and then they start sinking.
So this is a term that was invented to describe a number of bubbles, you might say, that occurred in 2011 and 2012. So there were literally four or five candidates, Michelle Bachmann, Herman Cain, Newt Gingrich twice, Rick Santorum. There was a lot of excitement initially. Then the news coverage turned, they were covered more critically, and then they declined after 4 to 6 weeks. So usually this happens when a candidate's near-term polling is out of line with what we call the fundamentals, right? Where you're kind of scratching your head and saying, I can't figure out why so many people think that candidate is so great. You could argue it's the case for Carson. His support is not very solid, meaning that people say, if you ask me right now, I'll vote for Ben Carson, but I haven't really made my mind up. If you had polls, by the way, that were honest right now, it would say 70% undecided, 6% Trump, 5% Rubio, 4% Carson. You know, that's probably a more accurate representation of how many people have really made up their mind so far.
That's why we keep saying polls are stupid. Primary polls are stupid.
One thing people don't realize about polls now is that there's a lot of processing that takes place to the data. So if you just call random landlines, you're going to get a lot of older white women to answer the phone. Young Latino men don't have landlines. Pollsters are aware of that. So what they'll do is say, well, we don't have enough Latinos. And so every Latino I get, I'm going to multiply them by 4. And every white woman I get, I'm going to cut her vote in half. At some point, the massaging fails to work and you have polls that can be quite inaccurate. Now, in the U.S., the polls in the aggregate have still been pretty good. You looked at 538, where you take a weighted average of polls, put more weight on the more accurate polls. That did pretty well. It called just about every state right.
Yeah, we know you're clairvoyant.
However, no, but I'm not. We're terrified also about the long-term direction of polls. There have been massive polling errors in the United Kingdom, in Israel, in Greece, in Scotland, and many other westernized democracies, and they're using the same basic techniques. So the fact that we've had these errors elsewhere is a sign that we could have trouble in the U.S. sooner or later, too.
And so from what we can tell, from the data we have, the media had a role in creating Donald Trump's prominence, but none in creating Ben Carson's.
Yeah.
So next time we talk, Nate, we're going to see if we can get closer to an answer to the chicken and the egg question. And I think that we may find a different variation of that answer for every candidate we look at.
Mm-hmm. And the answer can be both, and it can be self-reinforcing. So I think Trump has realized that as long as the hype cycle continues and you stay in motion, the media likes objects in motion instead of objects at rest. So Donald Trump is always in motion.
Nate, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nate Silver is the editor-in-chief of 538. Their election coverage is at 538.com/election, and you can find their podcast on iTunes. Coming up, 2015 has been declared the year of the political outsider. Happens every 4 years. This is On the Media.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Ben Carson was surging in the polls this week, and he did it by stressing that he's not like everybody else. He's an outsider.
I'm Ben Carson, and I'm running for president. The political class and their pundit buddies say impossible. He's too outside the box. I'm running for president, and I'm very much outside the box.
Naturally, the insiders also want out. I mean, in order to get really in.
Ted Cruz really is going into this week going to try to brand himself as the original outsider.
New Jersey Governor Chris Christie assures us that as the conservative governor of a liberal state, he's a rogue.
I wake up every morning as an outsider.
Former governor of Arkansas Mike Huckabee insists that he's the very definition of outside.
I've never had a D.C. zip code.
Jeb Bush, the scion of the nation's leading political dynasty, says he doesn't even know his way around Washington.
I wouldn't know how to drive. I can barely get from Dulles to Senator Grassley's office.
And former First Lady, Senator, and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton guarantees us that she's an outsider because, well, look at her.
Who can be more of an outsider than a woman president?
The media have taken note and have hereby declared 2016...
the year of the outsider.
Will 2016 be the year of the outside candidates?
The year of the political outsiders.
But here's the thing. If 2015 is the year of the outsider, then so too is 1828, when Andrew Jackson ran against the incumbent John Quincy Adams. Adams, a former Secretary of State and son of President John Adams, was the quintessential insider, dubbed His Excellency by critics. Jackson, no stranger to politics himself, having served in both houses, ran on his military record and reputation as a bare-knuckled frontiersman. Jackson won by a landslide. Abraham Lincoln was little known outside of Illinois and played up his rail-splitting outsiderness.
A rail-splitting statesman can do.
The campaign posters of Ulysses S. Grant in 1872 portrayed him as a tanner and his running mate Henry Wilson as a shoemaker. Neither was either.
I will beat them back with their own weapons and with Grant the tanner boy. Hurrah, hurrah.
In fact, Grant's campaign was underwritten by Cornelius Vanderbilt, Jay Cook, and John Astor. Even in the roaring 20s, the image of the politician as a simple, ordinary person of humble origins carried weight. Here's a Calvin Coolidge campaign song from 1924.
In a quaint New England farmhouse on an early summer's day, a farmer's boy became our chief in a homely, simple way.
Thus, the appeal of the outsider politician is eternal. Not so the reality. Up until the late 1960s, a candidate could boast all he wanted of his folksy upbringing. He still had to be selected by the party leaders in those smoke-filled rooms. This all came to a head at the notorious 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago.
You have this sort of literal inside and outside the party, and it became, you know, essentially a war in the streets.
Erica Seifert is author of the book The Politics of Authenticity in Presidential Campaigns. She says that an increase in the number of state primaries and reforms intended to open the primary process after 1968 suddenly made the possibility of a legitimate outside candidate real.
We have Jimmy Carter in 1976, who was an outsider, becoming the nominee of the Democratic Party. Jimmy Carter's credentials in 1976 weren't that he was, you know, a naval engineer, weren't that he was governor of Georgia, but instead that he was a peanut farmer from Plains, Georgia, who was, you know, just plain Jimmy.
Nobody in my family before my generation ever had a chance to finish high school. We've always worked for a living. We know what it means to work.
Contrast that with his opponent, sitting President Gerald Ford.
There was this conventional wisdom that a sitting president run what was called a Rose Garden strategy to show him being presidential in the Rose Garden. But there's a memo in August 1976 from his campaign that said that the president was lagging in the polls because he was seen as, quote, too much of a politician, part of the Washington establishment. And they said that he should avoid all bill signings and the like, which, quote, simply reinforced the perception of the president as part of the Washington establishment. So Gerald Ford is running for re-election not as a man who's competent to do the job, but as a man who's competent to be a Midwesterner.
So obviously, Jimmy Carter got elected. But then Ronald Reagan came along and played his own game against him.
It seems like the Carter team didn't learn from their own success in 1976 because the Carter campaign did run a Rose Garden strategy in 1980, and the Reagan campaign took full advantage of this.
So let's contrast a winning Carter ad from 1976 with one from 1980. The 76 one features throngs of ordinary people.
Hi, Governor Carter from Georgia. Sure. Running for president. I want to ask you to help me next year.
In the beginning, Jimmy Carter's campaign was a lonely one. But through the months, more and more people recognized him as a new leader, a man who will change the way this country is run.
And then we have an ad from 1980 depicting Carter lonely again, this time in the Oval Office at night.
Each day, many people come to the Oval Office with advice and information. But when it comes time to decide something, President Carter must decide alone.
The Reagan campaign ran focus groups on this Carter ad, and what's really neat is the focus group responses to this. They said that Jimmy Carter looked like he was sneaking in the back door.
Somehow, Reagan, even as a sitting president, managed to run as an outsider.
Stuart Spencer, one of Reagan's campaign advisors in 1984, said what set Reagan apart was that he was always an outsider in Washington, and he never lost his ear for what's outside.
We have an ad from 1984. It features a passing shot of Ronald Reagan, but it's almost entirely footage of small-town life, working-class people, and American flags.
On a Friday, just a few weeks ago, the barbershop closed 3 hours early. The mill shut its doors at noon. And all across the state, people were taking time out for something special. A train carrying the 40th President of the United States.
I love that ad. It's very much Reagan the outsider looking in with awe at the presidency that he's not quite of, right? That he's still admiring from the outside. In fact, when he kicked off his campaign, he said, quote, "I can't help but thank you for giving me an opportunity to get away from those puzzle palaces on the Potomac and return home to kick off our campaign."
Erica, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Erica Seifert is a research strategist for the National Education Association and author of the book, The Politics of Authenticity in Presidential Campaigns. The rest is history. Bill Clinton ran as an outsider.
I'm the only person up here who hasn't been part of Washington in any way for the last 20 years.
So did George W. Bush.
That Washington experience is not the only experience in the world. As a matter of fact, most people appreciate experience outside of Washington.
And the reason is always the same, dissatisfaction and distrust. Public trust in government is at an all-time low, but it often is. A 2014 study by Pew found a consistent pattern over the last 50 years. Low trust in the early 70s, followed by a rise, then a low in the 90s, then another rise, and then another low that we're in the midst of now. Paul Waldman is a senior writer for The American Prospect and blogger for The Washington Post. He says that even if our dream of an outsider has been around forever, it's a reality we're probably better off without.
We have this kind of shared myth that the only people who can fix the problems that exist in Washington are people who don't know anything about how the government works and are as far away from it as possible. It's something that we don't apply to any other kind of human endeavor. You know, if you needed a plumber and someone said, "I don't know anything about plumbing, but I'm a really good lawyer," you wouldn't want that guy to fix your pipes.
Can I just play devil's advocate here? If politics is about compromise and thinking of solutions, that maybe a non-expert could do a decent job at politics?
That's something that we often see in films, you know, like that movie Dave, where a guy who's pretending to be a politician comes in and fixes the federal budget with his buddy who's an accountant. It's as though no one in Washington has ever considered that gridlock maybe isn't all that helpful or that lobbyists have too much power. It's just never occurred to anyone in Washington. And so we need some new thinker from outside who can bring that common wisdom, and then everything will just transform. But you might remember that Barack Obama said that he was going to transform Washington's culture. And before him, George Bush said that he was going to transform Washington's culture. And before him, Bill Clinton said that he was going to transform Washington's culture. And he didn't do it either.
Does it never work?
The culture in Washington can change, but it's only going to change very slowly and incrementally. Mario Cuomo said that we campaign in poetry, but we govern in prose. Well, in a presidential campaign, when we're all listening to the poetry, we don't want to hear, "Well, I'm going to go there and we're going to make some small incremental changes, and little by little, we can begin to change those things." They want to hear that everything will be transformed when your favorite candidate gets elected.
You've got a Congress that is essentially ruled by seniority.
And that's when it really becomes farcical. The idea that somebody who is 435th in seniority is really going to have a fundamental impact on the way the institution works.
Washington is broken. It's time to clean house.
Well, Washington has let us down, and the politicians have let us down, and it's time to fix it.
Because I'm ready to stand tall for freedom and get Washington out of our lives.
You know, you can't say, you know, "Elect me and none of the fundamental things are really going to change, but I'll try to do as good a job as I can."
Mark Leibovich wrote last year that, quote, "skilled politicians have a proud tradition of conveying utter contempt for their profession, especially when they're running to keep their job."
That's another one of the strange things about politics, is that nobody can admit that there might be something noble about it and that doing a good job at it is something that should be valued, and the people who have done it for longer get better at it. Take something like passing a complex piece of legislation through Congress. That's an incredibly complicated task. It can take years. And you have to know a lot about a lot of different things and have a lot of different skills in order to do it. when politicians are talking about how everything's going to change because they're a different sort of person, they never explain exactly how they're going to do it, because the how is the really tricky part.
Senator Marco Rubio, since he took his Senate seat in 2011, he's missed 12.3% of all votes, which is, you know, 10 times more than the average senator. And he's taken some heat for it. But this week, the Washington Post ran an article saying that his skimpy voting record is, in fact, principled.
Yeah, so if you're a sitting senator, how are you going to define yourself as an outsider? Well, what Rubio is essentially saying is, I hate it there. I don't have anything to do with that place. It's not surprising that he would be frustrated and feel like nothing gets done there, because nothing really is getting done. Then you can have someone like Ted Cruz, also a senator who has never passed a piece of legislation. He actually has a legitimate claim to be something of an outsider, because apparently everyone in Washington, Republicans and Democrats, can't stand him. And when you ask him what he's accomplished, he'll say, well, I stood up to Obamacare. I stood up for this and I stood up for that, which basically meant he gave a bunch of speeches. He didn't actually do anything practical, but engaging in that fight against the entrenched power, both the Democratic power in the White House and the Republican power in his own party, to him is what makes him an outsider. And there's a fair number of people who think that's a persuasive argument.
Okay, so the two main establishment candidates, Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton, argue they're outsiders. So at this point, the terms become meaningless.
Yeah, absolutely. When Hillary Clinton got asked this question, she said something like, well, you can't be more of an outsider than being the first woman president.
It's not altogether far-fetched.
No, but it's not really about that same thing of searching for someone who's not tainted mm-hmm. by the ways of Washington. Her best argument as a presidential candidate is probably that she knows a lot about the way this system works. And she's been inside the White House, and she's been a senator, and she's been a cabinet member. She could argue that I understand this system better than anyone. And if you want to accomplish the things you want to accomplish, I'm the one who's going to be able to navigate it. But the voters are feeling like all the insiders have screwed everything up. Then candidates feel like they have to say, well, I'm not one of those people. I'm an outsider just like you.
I think you've hit on the fundamental thing that makes a candidate a winner. It's the picture of America and of the voter that they reflect back.
We demand that they be one of us. We want to know what's on their iPod and what television programs that they like. And are they real, authentic people? And that's why they always want to tell us that they started from humble beginnings, right? Mm-hmm. They're a little smarter than we are. They have a little more integrity than we do. And they're just like us, only a little bit better as they go and represent us in Washington.
Paul, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Paul Waldman is a weekly columnist and senior writer for the American Prospect and blogs for the Washington Post.
I'm Joni Ernst. I grew up castrating hogs on an Iowa farm. So when I get to Washington, I'll know how to cut pork.
Joni Ernst, mother, soldier, conservative.
Let's make them squeal.
In the Republican debate, Governor Chris Christie invoked FBI Director James Comey's recent statement on the supposed rise of crime post-Ferguson.
The FBI director has said this week that police officers are afraid to get out of their cars, that they're afraid to enforce the law. And he says, the president's appointee, that crime is going up because of this.
Indeed, last Friday, the FBI director lent his endorsement to the idea that rising crime in many cities across the country is due to something called the Ferguson effect. The idea that eyewitness cell phone videos and the increased visibility of police action generally emboldens criminals and impedes the police from doing their job, for fear of becoming another viral star. James Comey.
I spoke to officers privately in one big city precinct who described being surrounded by young people with mobile phones held high, taunting them when they get out of their cars. They said to me, "We feel under siege and we don't feel much like getting out of our cars."
The Ferguson effect theory was popularized by Manhattan Institute fellow Heather McDonald in a Wall Street Journal op-ed in May. She also wrote that the move away from stop and frisk and broken windows policing has contributed to the increase in crime. Jeffrey Fagan, professor of law at Columbia University, disputes these claims and casts doubt on the idea that we're experiencing a rise in crime.
If you look at homicide rates across the country in the nation's cities over the past 20 years, for the most part, there's been a decline overall in the long-term trend. One expects random fluctuation from year to year, even from month to month. It's the long-term trend that I think we have to think about.
Is there any credibility to the idea that because we're watching the police more closely, this is somehow an impediment to policing?
There's no evidence to suggest that's true. I think FBI Director Comey said he spoke to a few officers in one precinct in a large city. I don't think anybody's really done the very demanding task of doing a systematic survey of police officers representative of cities across the country.
So there's no data.
There is no systematic data. There's not even non-systematic data from a sampling of communities about what police are doing.
So let's say that the Ferguson effect hasn't got a real foundation. Why then is it being floated as a potentially credible idea by the FBI director?
FBI Director Comey would like to reform the way that police departments collect data. I think he wants to see these data be collected and reported out in a much quicker time frame, almost in real time, as many departments do. And I think he's trying to persuade them that he's sympathetic to their claims and that collecting such data would be in their best interest for helping to sustain their claims about particular dangers to police officers and police work, as well as to their claims about rising homicide rates across the country.
So you're saying he's raising this idea as a way to enlist support in data collection?
He can't really order the police departments to cooperate. It's one of the flaws in the FBI's data counting system. And so he has to do what he can to enlist their support to buy into the idea of stronger accountability through better data.
It seems an odd way to go about enlisting support, though. He seems to be suggesting that they can't really do their job well without violating civil rights.
You said that. I didn't.
But isn't that what the suggestion is here, that if they're watched, they won't get out of their cars because they might display misconduct that would get them into trouble? But aren't most police departments in favor of body cameras?
I think the management supports it. Police executives support it. I think local governments support it. Whether or not the rank-and-file officer supports it, I think there's mixed opinions.
Let me throw in some of the other culprits to rising crime that Heather McDonald brought up. She said that the broken windows theory of policing, where you prosecute for minor crimes and patrol for minor crimes, and that way you'll prevent bigger crimes, and also stop and frisk, that these sorts of things were helpful, and now that the national trend is moving away from them, this is contributing to crime.
From the middle of 2012 through the end of 2014, there were very, very steep declines in the number of stops and frisks that were conducted in New York City. During the same period of time, the crime rate went down. Broken windows theory is extremely popular, but there's no evidence that actually that is keeping the crime rate low.
No evidence?
Very little evidence. Almost no evidence. There have been some reviews of different experiments across the country, and the reviews tend to show that the presence of police in a particular location actually has a deterrent effect. But aggressive policing in those places, either through aggressive stops or through high rates of misdemeanor arrests, just simply doesn't produce the kind of crime declines that you would expect. It's one thing to send the police to areas that have high crime rates. It's quite another to ask what they do when they get there.
There was a correlation between increased incarceration and decreasing crime, at least for a while.
Well, in the 1980s, the incarceration rates went up while the crime rates were going up. In the 1990s, the incarceration rates went up and the crime rates were going down. So you can't have it both ways.
So what's the real reason behind crime decline over the past few decades, do you think?
There are so many factors operating simultaneously and operating in interaction with one another that it's hard to sort out any single explanation. I think the media and probably the general public are somewhat uncomfortable with multiple causes. I think they tend to look for single explanations. It's more reassuring and it's more digestible. And so whether it be broken windows this week or the Ferguson effect next week or drug epidemics the week before, these explanations are thrown out in isolation. I think it's important to educate the public and for the media to take on that task of saying things are complicated, folks.
To what extent do you think the whole issue has been politicized by pundits and the media in general? In the case of the Ferguson effect, it seems to be used to discredit the Black Lives Matter movement.
Just this morning on NPR, there was a story about Governor Christie making a claim that the Black Lives Matter movement was inciting violence against police officers. If I were doing the interview with Governor Christie, I would have said, Governor, Can you point to any particular homicide of a police officer or shooting of a police officer that can be attributed in some direct or even an indirect way to something that was said by a member of the Black Lives Matter movement? And the answer would be no. Has there been an increase in the number of shootings and fatalities among police officers? And the answer there is no. So what's the basis for your claim, Governor? But of course, that conversation didn't happen, and Christie probably would have gotten up and left the room at that point. Seriously, though, these are claims that are being thrown out without a lot of challenges to the substance or basis for the claim, and I think that's irresponsible.
But wouldn't you give the media some credit for addressing police brutality and mass incarceration and making them election issues?
Yes. I do give you credit for that. But look at it this way. For how many years were there cases involving racial profiling across the country by police? For how many years was stop and frisk an issue that was a source of great unhappiness to the Black community in New York? How many years was that going on before the media began to pay attention to it? There was a great deal of attention to policing after Rodney King. It died away. Then there was a great deal of attention to policing after the Rampart scandal in Los Angeles, and then that died away. I think that the interest is episodic. It tends to happen in big ticket events. I don't think it's systematic.
Jeffrey, thank you very much.
Okay.
Jeffrey Fagan is a professor of law at Columbia University. Coming up, the Boston Globe's Pulitzer Prize-winning investigation of sex abuse by priests is now on the big screen. And yet, it's accurate. This is On the Media.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. 2 weeks ago, I saw the movie Truth. It depicts a CBS News team in 2004 rushing to report a story about how George W. Bush's connections enabled him to avoid Vietnam by winning him a coveted spot in the National Guard, and then how he ducked that service, too. It was a story that had been told before, but the CBS team's emphasis on some dubious documents killed the chance for any follow-up and cost them their jobs, including Dan Rather's. As a viewer who's also in the news biz, seeing these reporters portrayed as unambiguously heroic didn't feel right, because while their intentions were fine, their process was so flawed they did more harm than good. But the film glossed over that, directing blame to venal network execs and a biased review process instead. And while some of that may be justified, it still made me queasy. I had a very different experience watching the next journalism film coming down the pike. Spotlight opens in theaters next week. It chronicles how the Boston Globe's investigative unit, called Spotlight, uncovered decades of child abuse by priests in the Boston Catholic Archdiocese and of the church covering it up. Walter Robinson headed the investigation. He's played by Michael Keaton in the film. And Sasha Pfeiffer was one of four reporters on the team. She's played by Rachel McAdams. Robbie, Sasha, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks, Brooke.
Thanks, Brooke, and we're sorry Michael Keaton and Rachel couldn't be here today.
Leave it for those other shows. Anyway, the film takes place between 2001 and early 2002. The investigation starts when a new editor arrives at the Globe. And Robbie, you're meeting with Marty Baron, who's played by Liev Schreiber, in a restaurant. And he asks you how Spotlight operates.
Well, we are a four-person investigative team, and we keep our work confidential.
What are you working on now?
We just put out a piece on a shoddy construction outfit, and right now we're really just trolling around for our next story.
How long does that typically take?
Hard to say. A couple of months.
A couple months?
Yeah, we don't like to rush it. Once we settle on a project, we can spend a year or more investigating it. Is that a concern?
Not necessarily. But from what I understand, readership is down. Internet is cutting into the classified business. And I think I'm going to need to take a hard look at things.
A couple of years on a story, it seems like such a luxury to even contemplate today.
Well, in fact, today many newspapers spend no time on investigative reporting, and that's a tragedy for people who depend upon newspapers to hold important institutions accountable.
Spotlight is still going on at the Globe, right?
Spotlight is still going on. They just produced a very good long story about Massachusetts General Hospital, where doctors very often perform two surgeries at the same time on patients without, by the way, telling the patients. And that project took almost a year.
And yet, as recently as this week, there's been a whole other round of cuts at the Globe.
That's correct. The Globe went from about 350 employees down to about 315. Although relative to other similar-sized papers, the Globe staff is still 50% or more larger.
And Brooke, not only is the Spotlight team actually still alive and well, it's larger than it was when we were on it about a decade ago. It's now six reporters, and they've added sort of a companion SWAT team. They don't call it that, but it allows investigative reporters to team up with beat reporters so they can turn around good investigative stories faster. So the Globe is still doing a lot of investigative journalism.
As it did even while Marty was cutting way back then. And interestingly, he's the man who launched the investigation.
You know, he came from Miami, and Florida has the best public records law in the country. And he came to Massachusetts, which has among the worst. Government is not accessible at all. We consider ourselves to be the Mississippi of public records. So Marty arrives, and the very first story he reads before he comes to work is a column by Eileen McNamara about one priest, John Gagan, who is facing 84 lawsuits. And the column notes that the records provided by the archdiocese to the plaintiff's attorney are under seal. And she further wrote, "The truth may never be known." And to Marty Baron, that is a red flag.
And Marty was such an example of what a pair of fresh eyes can do, because many of us over the years had reported on various clergy sex abuse cases, and most people never questioned whether we should wonder why they're sealed. We just accepted that they were sealed. Marty came in and said, "Have we tried to get the seal lifted off these documents?" And sort of an embarrassed answer, no, and he set us out to try to do that. The church, unlike nonprofits and public companies and government agencies, they don't have to give us records. You can't send them a public record request. They don't have to file tax returns. So as a reporter, it's a real challenge to think, how do you get that story when they don't have to and don't want to tell you anything?
And the first thing you did was to go back to people with whom the Globe had dealt before, but kind of discounted as being fanatical or difficult to deal with. That sort of thing.
In fact, there's a seminal moment in the film, and it was a seminal moment in our investigation, when we had in an abuse victim who was the leader of the local chapter of the Survivors Network of those abused by priests. And he came in with a box of documents, and among the very first things he said to us is, "You know, I gave you guys this stuff 5 years ago."
Talk to Richard Sipe. He worked in one of the church's treatment centers. He's an ex-priest. Here. This is his testimony from the Cost case.
Phil, what's a treatment center?
It's where they send priests when they get caught. This is all right here in the box. I sent this all to you guys 5 years ago.
To the Globe. Who did you send it to?
I don't want to say who, but they said that they weren't interested.
But Phil, we did run a couple stories on you. I saw them in the clips.
Yeah, but to be completely frank, it wasn't enough. You guys got to understand, this is big. This is not just Boston. This is a whole country. It's a whole world.
One thing that always happens, particularly with daily newspapers, is people are constantly calling, wanting to tell you stories. And very often they are people who are saying there's a conspiracy here. You have to uncover it. And 9 times out of 10, these are people who are perhaps off their meds. But the fact of the matter is, there are people who sound like they're a little troubled because they are victims of a conspiracy. And we miss those stories, and that happened in this case.
In fact, there are hints of that all through the film, Robbie. Echoes of the Globe having had tantalizing hints that it didn't follow up on. One of the crucial ones in the film is an allegation of 20 abusive priests that ended up buried in the metro section, and there is a quick effort to think about how did it end up being buried? Why wasn't it followed up on? And you were the guy in charge of Metro.
And the story came from a lawyer who was letting us know that there were 20 priests who he said had abused children whom he had reported to the archdiocese. And we dutifully published that in the paper and never followed up on it. And when it came up in 2001 or 2002, none of us, including myself, remembered the story at all.
I think that's why we love this movie.
Me too.
In real life, people are flawed, and the movie captures that. It shows what we did well and what we should have done sooner, and that's really authentic to real life and to real reporting.
There is so much that is authentic about this film. And actually, I was going to ask you about that. What was it like being impersonated? I mean, I know you guys were on the set. The actors and the writers kept interviewing you. We have a clip from director and writer Tom McCarthy, who's sitting with co-writer Joe Singer on that very issue.
Interviewing reporters is a nightmare.
Totally.
You know, it's like trying to heal a doctor. Like, reporters just don't want to be interviewed. They like asking the questions. And we had to ask some tough questions. And you could tell, we walked out of a lot of interviews like, well, we're going to have to go back because they didn't give us what we needed.
That is so funny to hear because I know in my case, I felt very guarded at the beginning. They asked very probing and sometimes personal questions like, how did this project affect your marriage? Did you cook dinner with your husband? What kind of haircut did you have? Did you wear jewelry? We spent a lot of time with our actors. We took walks, we had dinners, and I just thought of those as walks and dinners. But then when we saw the movie and we realized they were depicting our mannerisms, we realized that all those walks and dinners were homework. They were research projects in which we were being studied.
My first dinner with Michael Keaton in New York, I was quite uncomfortable because I had found out earlier that he had been listening to previous old videotapes of appearances I had made. So he arrived for our first meeting. He had my voice down. And he looked at me at one point. He said, you know, you really don't have that much of a Boston accent. And I said, well, how would you know? He said, well, believe me, I know your voice. And it was a little disconcerting.
A London tabloid noted, Rachel McAdams dresses down for a role as investigative journalist, citing her messy tresses, clunky loafers, baggy clothes.
She looked so much like me in this one scene where she was photographed. And then the next day when the press basically eviscerated her outfit, it was hilarious because she got me so right. But clearly my outfits are not what people expect celebrities to be wearing.
Rachel McAdams said about you, you're one of those people that everyone wants to talk to, that you're an extraordinary listener, you're compassionate, and that part of your role on the team was to draw out the stories of the victims. We have a little clip.
So he said, you know what'll help is if we play strip poker. Of course I lost. And things went on from there.
Can you tell me specifically what happened?
Specifically, he molested me.
Joe, I think that language is going to be so important here. We can't sanitize this. Just saying molest isn't enough. People need to know what actually happened.
We should probably get these to go.
Right.
That clip, I think, is a reminder for all of us that at the root of this story was this terrible tragedy, you know, in which many people, usually boys, when they were adolescents, had a really traumatic thing happen to them that many of them never recovered from. And we needed details that were sometimes uncomfortable for people to tell us. And because I was the only woman on the team, I believed that it was often easier for men to tell me what had happened. They were talking about things that they were embarrassed about and ashamed about.
On almost any story, Brooke, Sasha could talk the dog off the beat wagon. And there was one story actually involving a priest who was in charge of young teenage girls who were studying to become nuns. And he introduced them to sex by persuading them that he was Jesus Christ on earth. And Sasha picked up the phone, reached this priest, and for 45 minutes, she talked to this priest, and he acknowledged it all. He went on and on because Sasha kept asking the right questions in the right way. If I had called him up, he probably would have hung up in my ear.
Was the timing of this story crucial to its impact? I know that this was one of the earliest stories to go viral on the internet. But was there also something to do with a changing view, perhaps in Boston, towards the institution of the Catholic Church?
You know, even though the movie makes clear that we probably could have done this story years earlier if we'd really put our minds to it, if we had done it earlier, the stories would not have gone on the web. And because it did go on the web, our stories weren't just read in the Boston area. They were read all over the country. That meant tip calls came pouring in, and that helped our reporting. But Brooke, you're right. I think the deference that the Catholic Church got, particularly in a city like Boston, was really beginning to erode by the time we did our stories. And, you know, this is a beloved, powerful institution, and many people just didn't question its authority for many decades. And this has taught us why it's important to ask tough questions of institutions like the church, because this is how tragedies like this happen when you don't.
There's an amazing scene at the end when you decide that you're going to go into the Spotlight office on the weekend because you've left a phone number, a tip line, in case anybody wants to call you. And it was almost too cinematic to be true. The phone is just ringing off the hook.
It was absolutely true. It was absolutely true.
Just like that.
It was men, usually men, calling from all around the country. And so many of these men thought for decades that they were the only person that had been abused. And suddenly they find out that there had been dozens of other people, hundreds of other people. And they began calling us.
And many of them had never told anyone in their family what had happened to them. I still remember an 87-year-old man from Millinocket, Maine, who called to tell me about the abuse he had suffered 75 years earlier. And I was the first one he had ever told about it.
I think it was actually you, Robbie, that often said it was as if we were grief counselors who hadn't been trained to be grief counselors. We spent a lot of time on the phone with men in tears. And I think that was very disturbing, but ultimately very angering. And anger can be a motivator. And I think in our case, it motivated us to work even harder on this story.
It's unimaginable, whether you're Catholic or not, that an institution like this could countenance, enable, and cover up thousands of cases of children having their lives shattered by this kind of heinous behavior. And yet it happened everywhere for so long. It changed our concept of what we should report. After that, we consciously looked for stories that involve victimized populations. Stories where people were getting run over by society and they had no one but us to tell their story.
What does it feel like to have this all coming back in this way 13 years later?
I think we're still processing that. Recently, some more clergy sex abuse lawsuits have been filed in the Boston area. And I think that as word of the movie spreads, some people are coming forward for the first time.
Those of us who believe in the power of the printed word are a little gobsmacked at the moment because we're now beginning to think that this film has the potential to really raise public consciousness on important issues of journalism and treatment of children that aren't possible to do with the printed word.
And, you know, we certainly hope it keeps the church working hard to try to make sure this doesn't happen again. We also hope that it reminds people how important investigative journalism is. You have to support this work. That means buying your newspaper, get a digital subscription, get home delivery. That's the revenue that helps us do what we do, because this is an industry that's in really rough shape.
Walter Robinson and Sasha Pfeiffer are journalists. They work at the Boston Globe. Thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Alex Friedland and Dasha Litsitsina, and our show was edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Greg Rippin and Casey Means. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
So
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.